to me, it said we could build a little package like this, that we could do, we could select any wavelength we wanted, make measurements on different materials and that sort of thing. It was a way of making a very inexpensive but very versatile little infrared analyzer. And I learned that the filter was manufactured by a company in the West Coast called Optical Coating Laboratories, OCLI. The president was Ralph Ilsley. And I got back to Norwalk, and I called up OCLI, and I said, I'm interested in your circular variable filter. Is there somebody there who could talk to me about it? Oh, yes, that's our president, Ralph Ilsley. This is his pet project. So Ralph gets on the telephone, and I told him what I thought about it, and he said, well, you couldn't have hit me at a better time because Beckman has backed out of the project. They don't think they can make any use of it, and we've got to figure out something. He said, come out and visit. So I flew out to San Francisco, and as I arrived at the airport, I'm paged, and I pick up the phone, and Mr. Ilsley is waiting for you in the commercial aviation section. Well, he had his own plane, and he'd flown down, and I went over there, and he flew me up to Santa Rosa, which is 100 miles or so north of San Francisco, to their plant. And we had a great visit, and I finally ended up by saying that we would buy up all of the Beckman filters that they made. We buy them from Beckman, and then he'd make more for us, and we'd change the design a little bit. And so I came back, and Tony and I looked at it and decided, what are we going to do with this filter? Well, this was right at the time when the automobile or the emissions people were looking for emissions analyzers, gasoline engines, you know, NH and NOXs and carbon monoxide and that sort of thing, which you could do very nicely by infrared because they all have characteristic bands. So Tony developed a long path gas cell that was somewhat similar to the white cell. John White had developed one several years ago while he was at PerkinElmer, but it had some faults. It was very difficult to change the path length in the white cell. But Tony had a very clever design where you could rotate a mirror and convert it from a meter path length up to 20 meters. We could go through it, and we developed. And our object was to sell it to the emissions people in New Jersey and wherever they were setting up emission centers. By the time the instrument came out, we were behind. Other people had come along with gas analyzers, and they captured the market and so forth. However, the OSHA had just come into existence at that stage, and the world was very concerned about toxic vapors in the workspace, in the atmosphere. And all of a sudden, our instrument was just the one that was needed. And we walked into this market without really realizing it. The one that we'd headed out originally to try to sell the instrument to was gone, but this one, and that's the instrument that you have here. It's a big Kluge instrument, but probably at least 10,000 of those instruments are sold, and they're still being used today. There's nothing that has really taken their place, although there is going to be one that will. But anyway, that led Wilk Scientific into a totally different business. Instead of being an accessory manufacturer, we became an instrument company. And I got interested in this stage in interference filters, because there's so many things you can do with them. They give you a narrow band pass, and my interest always has been to find practical applications for infrared. And what you learn is that an FTIR or a prism instrument will develop an application, and they'll pick out an absorption band, and if we measure that absorption band, we can control this process. Well, you don't need an infrared spectrometer to do that. All you need is a filter instrument, a filtrometer, which is what we started making at Wilk Scientific. And we developed two instruments. One was a gas analyzer. The other was an infrared probe where we had an optical element we could stick into a beaker and analyze what was in the beaker. Well, for various reasons, that never got to be very successful, but the gas analyzer was tremendously successful. And I have to tell you a little Perkin Elmer Beckman story at this stage. We had at Wilk Scientific this Model 9 ATR attachment, and I loaned one to Bob Hanna in the application laboratory at Perkin Elmer. Three months later, I went to a spectroscopy meeting in Chicago, and one of my friends said, "Hey, you got to go in the Perkin Elmer booth." I go into the Perkin Elmer booth, and here's a carbon copy of this instrument with the Perkin Elmer label on it. Same mirrors, everything. And I got upset at this. And when I got back to Norwalk, I called up Chester Nimitz, who was the president, junior, who was president of Perkin Elmer, and I said, "Chester, I'd like to come up and visit you." "Oh, sure, Paul, anytime." So I remember one snowy afternoon, I drove up to Perkin Elmer, which is about 10 miles north of us. I took my instrument. I had purchased one of the Perkin Elmer instruments. I went over to his office, I sat down on the table, and I said, "Chester, why did you copy this?" I said, "I loaned it to you so that we would be glad to make it for you, put it on your own label and that sort of thing." And he looked at me, he said, "I'm going to build this company 20% a year." And he said, "You don't have a patent on that, do you?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'm going to copy steel, or I'm going to build this company." And he said, "You've been patented on anything you develop next time." Anyway, down the line, 3 or 4 years later, we had this 20-meter gas cell. And Beckman came to us and said, "Can you adapt this to fit into an infrared spectrometer?" We worked on it, and yes, we did. And there is a wonderful book that they put out on OSHA compliance testing using an infrared spectrometer and a 20-meter gas cell, which we made for them. Perkin Elmer came to us and said, "Can you put it in our Model 21? And he said, "Sure, we can do the optics and so forth." After we had been delivering them to Perkin Elmer for about 6 months, the Perkin Elmer purchasing agent called me up and he said, "Hey, Paul," he said, "how come you sell the same cell to Beckman for 90% of what you sell them to Perkin Elmer?" And I said, "This is the way we're getting back at you guys for copying our instrument." And literally, we charged Perkin Elmer 10% more off for years. And I always remember that there's always a way to get back at somebody. So, but anyway, that cell led Wilk Scientific into gas analysis, and we designed a lot of similar instruments that were portable, easy to carry around, dedicated instrument. Or if you wanted a versatile one, you got the Marin 1A, which is what you have downstairs here. And the company grew, and we were growing very rapidly. We were growing faster than we could generate cash to support our growth. And I remember we sold a 40% interest in the company to EG&G. And I made a deal with them that 2 years down the pike, if one or the other could offer to buy the remaining interest in the company. And if that happened, EG&G made an offer to buy the 60%, no, the 40, the 60% that we still own, we could buy back the 40% at the same price. We had 6 months to raise the money to do it. Well, we did trigger the thing. We said to them, "We'd like to buy back the 40% interest. Make us an offer for the 60%. And I remember we had a big pool in the office when they had 30 days to come up with a price. And we were betting, you know, what are they going to offer for us? You know, this sort of thing. Well, it turned out they offered us half what anybody in the company had thought the company was worth. And we had 6 months to come up with the money to buy back EG&G. And we found a company that was International Nickel, which we hired a financial guy to try to find a partner. And he came in with International Nickel that was trying to expand into high-tech business. And they paid twice as much as EG&G had offered for the 40% interest in the company. So we bought back EG&G. Sold the 40% to International Nickel and had some working capital. But anyway, a few years later, we reached the point where we were still capital tight, and we couldn't go public in those days because this was in the mid-70s. The stock market was terrible. There was tremendous inflation. There was no market for new issues. And Bendix came after us, and they wanted to buy us to fit us in with one of their groups they had in West Virginia that was involved with infrared. And I almost sold the company to Bendix, but Foxborough heard that we were available. And I remember I was in Holland with my son. He was working in our English facility at that time. I met him in Amsterdam. We were sitting in a Holiday Inn, and I get a telephone call. And it was from the treasurer, or the vice president of Foxborough. And he said, Paul, he said, don't sell to Bendix. We really want you. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I turned off the Bendix deal. And what Fox, he had a very good idea. Foxborough was a company that made process instruments, process control instruments, basically temperature, pressure, and flow. That's all they did. His attitude was, we need these new technologies. We need infrared, we need gas chromatography, we need conductivity. Mm. And he went out and bought a conductivity company, an infrared company, which was us, and a GC company. And these are going to operate as satellites to the main company. You go on doing your own thing, but we'll use your technology to expand our process control application. Well, it worked fine until a guy named Chuck McKay was put in charge of these satellite companies, and his attitude was, he's going to build another Foxborough. He's going to bring them all in under one area and combine them, that was the kiss of death as far as I was concerned, because I didn't want any part of being part of Foxborough. I was very happy to run my little segment of Foxborough down in Norwalk. Mm-hmm. So that led me out of Foxborough. But anyway,
if we can pause a little at Wilkes Scientific prior to the Foxborough deal, the customers, same thing as before?
Basically, yes. We were selling to the chemical processing industry. That's our big market.
Right. And in terms of OSHA and the sort of new market in the environmental area, how did you track that? How did you sort of see that market emerging?
Well, I think it sort of came to us in a sense that all of a sudden OSHA was concerned about workplaces. Mm-hmm. And I guess we recognized that we had the kind of instrument that could be. I remember going down to a pharmaceutical company, in New Jersey.
Merck?
No, it was a Cyanamid subsidiary, which has since been merged with somebody else, but they wanted to measure ethylene chloride in the atmosphere, which was used for sterilizing and that sort of thing. And I think that was the first time we ever tried using this instrument, and we discovered it worked very well. We could put it in a corridor and we could wave the wand around and figured out the worst place to stand to be in this corridor were these alcoves where they had desks and people sat there. Even though they had fans blowing out in the middle, the alcoves had high concentrations of the gas. Well, that's the kind of thing you learn from it.
Right.
So anyway, we began to realize that this was a very good potential market. And we advertised, we went to shows. And I went to a meeting in Washington. It wasn't vinyl chloride, it was ethylene chloride in there, but vinyl chloride. Do you remember there was a big scare about vinyl chloride? There was a group of men who worked in a vinyl chloride plant in Cincinnati, and they'd worked there for 10 years, and most of them got cancer. Well, that's what really ticked off OSHA, and they made big regulations about vinyl chloride. And I went to a meeting in Washington. And this was put on by the Department of Labor, and they were trying to establish limits for vinyl chloride in the atmosphere. And they knew I came from an instrument company, and they pointed to me out in the audience, and they asked me to stand up, and they said, you make an instrument that can measure ambient air. How low can you measure vinyl chloride in the atmosphere? And I, without thinking, said, I don't know, we can probably get down to a part per million. That's the level. And immediately they set one part per million because it was feasible to measure that. Not because it made any sense, because these guys who are exposed to it were exposed to 10,000 parts per million day after day, you know. But anyway, they established this ridiculous low. Well, we sold a lot of instruments to the Mayo-Chloride field because we had the only instrument that would measure down to the OSHA limit, you know.
But, I mean, in a sense, OSHA didn't have the health and safety data, so they went to the measurement level.
Yeah. The typical reaction was, how low can you measure? Right. They still do this today, you know. Mm-hmm. It bugs me. Like arsenic in water, for example, parts per billion. Well, you can stand a lot higher level of arsenic, but because we have techniques that will measure that low, mm-hmm. that's where they set the limit. Without any real scientific study, what's harmful and what isn't. But we made a lot of money on it, so I can't be upset, but it really bothered me that they made decisions based on lack of scientific or medical history or whatever. So anyway.
Well, so this is happening,
the late 60s, right?
This was in the early 70s.
Okay,
our instrument came out in 1971, the Myron analyzer.
Right.
Myron stands for Miniature Infrared Analyzer. That's the acronym. And so it was in the 70s when this business, you know, the OSHA business expanded, and we expanded, and we ran out of capital because we expanded too fast, and that's what led us to sell out to Foxborough. Mm-hmm.
Did OSHA, in the same time period, like with the EPA, they're defining analytical methods, even saying, you know, so if you're going to analyze water, use a GCMS, you know, da-da-da-da-da. What was OSHA doing?
No. OSHA just wanted something to measure, you know, a piece of equipment to measure. Now, I've worked a lot lately with the EPA, and they're totally different. They define methods. You know, this is the way you're going to make the measurement, you know. But OSHA, the attitude was, here's the limit we set, and then you've got to find a piece of equipment that will measure that
mm-hmm.
limit. So. So anyway, that takes me through Wilk Scientific, which of all of my companies was probably my favorite one.
How many employees did you have?
We had, at that time, we had 220-odd employees. Now, the reason for this was that at that time, we couldn't farm out our manufacturing. We were not in our neighborhood or anywhere that the kind of optical shops that we needed to do infrared optics or electronic assembly or machine shop. Mm-hmm. So we had to have, within Wilk Scientific, all the resources to build our product. Today, it's totally different because especially in our part of Connecticut, Fairfield County, there are optical shops that do beautiful work on infrared optics, and there are machine shops, there are electronic assembly, circuit design people. My next company, GAC, got up to the same volume with 60 people instead of 120 people because we farmed out everything.
Yeah.
But the Wilk Scientific had a large number of employees for just this reason.
Hmm. And how did you act as manager? I mean, were you focused on new product development, or you were focused on marketing and sales? Are you overseeing all of it?
Combined. My prime interest is to recognize an opportunity in the marketplace mm-hmm. that can use my technology. So I really concentrate on where can we apply infrared spectroscopy in the marketplace. And what's happened in infrared over the years is that other programs like the space program have developed new infrared detectors, new infrared materials have come out of other programs, and it lets us instrument people apply them mm-hmm. to what I call real world problems, you know, solving like OSHA or solving problems in chemical industry or whatever. And we're constantly able to make use of infrared in smaller and less expensive devices that are more sensitive. You know, this is mm-hmm. the way the world turns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Today we're getting the same kind of help from the computer industry. We get these little chips, you know. Mm-hmm. I've got a whole infrared spectrometer right here, you know, just in microelectronics. And it, so, but anyway, that when Chuck McKay began to gather all these satellite companies together in Foxborough, again, I said, this is not me, you know, I don't want to be part of a big organization.
If I can, I mean, I guess I want to, let me try asking the same question a little differently. I mean, what was your management style at Wilkes? How would you characterize
it? Well, I think it was to try to have the best people I could get take responsibility for various aspects of the business. Like mm-hmm. Tony Gilby was our chief engineer, and I had a good production guy, and then had people who worked in the laboratory. I think I'm very weak in financial management because we're always way ahead of the resources we have to do what we want to do. But and I tried to develop a team of people that we could have our Monday morning meetings and do our planning. But the company, the manufacturing side, pretty well work itself. I did, mm-hmm. and I spent really most of my time looking for new markets for our existing products, or looking for markets where we could develop a new product to fill that market. That's where I concentrated my efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people that worked for me at Wilkes Scientific came along to General Analysis, and some of them are with me today. A couple of people, one of them was from Wilkes Scientific, another from GAC, and we're beginning to take on other people from companies that I've had who are still available in the area. So,
mm-hmm.
But I think you asked the question, I think my management skills are basically marketing and applying a technology to the marketplace,
yeah.
and that's the way
yeah.
I function. So anyway, I got... We have one more company to go through.
Well, I was going to suggest, do we want to pause?
It's up to you. When I was at PerkinElmer, I was in charge of the first exhibit they ever put on, which was in Grand Central Palace, which was an exhibit hall right next to Grand Central Station in New York. It was a chemical industries exhibit, and I was all by myself setting up a booth there. We had a Model 12 with a big thing around it, and there was this rather stocky, tall, bald guy who was standing in the background, and he watched me. He kept coming back and watching me, and he finally came over to me after I got the booth all set up. He said, I'm Arnold Beckman, and he said, I know who you are. You're from PerkinElmer, and he said, we're building an infrared activity in the West Coast, and I'd like to have you consider coming out and joining us. And I thought about this for a while, and you know, this is like somebody from Yale approaching a Harvard man.
Yeah.
And I was very polite, and I said, no, I don't think I really want to do this. And I went back and I told Van that, and Van said, well, he said, they're trying to build their business, and if you want to go ahead. If you want to live in California. And I said, no, I'm going to stay in Connecticut. But I was very pleased to do this. This very nice gentleman knew who I was and said, well, and anyway, I've seen him a number of times after that. But okay, well, we're...
So you let drop an interesting comment about Foxborough,
uh-huh.
and prior to it, you said you were visiting with your son in Europe, in Amsterdam.
Yes.
So you had taken Wilkes Scientific international.
Yes, we had a facility in Milton Keynes, which was a growing area in England at that time, and he had gone through a divorce situation and that sort of thing, and he was looking for a job, and I hired him.
Yeah.
And he went over there, and he really helped set up that facility, because we did some manufacturing there. My interest in going to England was the British have a lot of good ideas, and you can often get some good. They're lousy at running a company, you know, building a marketing, that sort of thing, but they have good ideas. And I thought if we had a facility in England, it would help us. Besides, we had a lot of business there at the time. So we had quite a successful operation in Milton Keynes, and Don was working for me there.
Now, of course, environmental and health regulations were completely different. I mean, were you monitoring?
But they're very similar in England. They had a very similar thing to OSHA. And we were doing final assembly on these Myron analyzers in England, because we could get inside the customs barrier by having partially assembled equipment, that sort of thing. And we were doing a good business in England and also on the continent. So it made sense to have a facility there. We always had a good export business in all of my companies, and I used to travel a great deal to Europe selling accessories and instruments and that sort of thing. So anyway,
Foxborough.
I left Foxborough, and I had an idea that there was so much interest in occupational environment monitoring that we could set up a company doing that service. And in fact, Don came with me too. He left Foxborough about the same time, and I talked him into setting up a facility to equip vans with instrumentation. And I went to Foxborough and made a deal with them that I could buy analyzers, Myron analyzers from them. And we tried to build a business offering services in doing workspace monitoring. Well, this was about the time Ronald Reagan became president. And Reagan put the clamps on occupational health, and it killed the business. It was absolutely dead, and it never took off the ground. But while I was with Foxborough, just before I left, I had gotten interested in a new type of internal reflection optical element, which was something that I came up with, which was to have a cylinder that we could reflect energy down through, and we could surround the cylinder with liquid and use it as a measuring tool. And I got interested in the beverage industry, that they needed to measure sugar in water. That's something we could do with this kind of an approach. And also carbon dioxide and water. And these are the two principal things that are measured when you're making Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or whatever. And we actually started a program at Foxborough, and then when I left Foxborough, I forgot all about it while we were trying to do this occupational health thing. And then I went back and decided maybe there's a real potential here, because the beverage industry really needed something that would monitor the quality of their product. So we went developed a process monitor based on circular internal reflection, which is a sensing tool, and Don did a lot of the design work on it, and I came up with some optical concepts that are quite different than what we ever had before. Very interesting sidelight was that when I was at Foxborough, I applied for a patent on circular internal reflection optical element. I did this at Wilk Scientific before we sold to Foxborough. And we didn't have any money at this stage, and the first stage of the patent, they came back, and as they always do, they knock everything down, you know, and they expect you to come back and fight for this. And we didn't have the resources, and Don, my son, was never happy about patents. He said they're a waste of time, people can copy them, so we just let it die. Well, a patent issued, and it issued covering a variable path length scheme that we put into the patent, but it didn't cover they wouldn't give us the basic concept of circular internal reflection. So when we started developing an instrument at GAC using circular internal reflection, I got this very nice letter from Foxborough saying, you're infringing on our patent. And I wrote back and I said, please read the patent carefully, because you will find that it doesn't cover circular internal reflection at